movie and entertainment business. We believe deeply in its future, and we want to help preserve and strengthen it.
Paramount launches a hostile takeover bid for Warner Brothers, trying to challenge the Netflix deal.
For Monday, December 8th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsie Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The conservative majority on the Supreme Court appears ready to back President Trump's decision to fire the Federal Trade Commissioner.
It is not proper for Congress to peel away executive power from the president and give it to someone who's not answerable to the voters.
Also, how some Republican lawmakers are trying to assert their independence from President Trump.
And the weird popularity of a scary holiday monster from Europe who carries a whipping stick.
He's horrible with like lank, greasy hair and sort of cramming children into his mouth.
Those stories and more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Paramount has launched a hostile takeover bid for Warner Brothers Discovery. The effort comes after Netflix announced its own $72 billion deal to acquire the company. The takeover attempts mean Paramount will go straight to Warner shareholders with a bid worth about $74 billion. Unlike Netflix, Paramount is also offering to buy the cable television assets of Warner Brothers, which includes CNN. Healthcare subsidies that were expanded during the pandemic expire at the end of the month. NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports on the push on Capitol Hill to renew them.
The Senate will vote this week on a Democratic bill that extends existing health care tax credits for 3 years. Senate Majority Leader John Thune says it is not a serious proposal. The Democrats' bill is not expected to advance, and Thune has not decided if the GOP will put up its own alternative. In the House, Virginia Republican Jen Kiggins is pushing a bipartisan proposal for a shorter extension.
I have 40,000 people in my district who rely on this health care, and doing nothing to prevent a spike in their premiums is wrong.
House Speaker Mike Johnson says he will unveil a bill this week and hold a vote before the end of the year. Lawmakers from both parties say if President Trump fails to negotiate a deal, Congress won't be able to head off major price increases. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News.
The Supreme Court seems likely to expand the president's control over independent agencies like the Federal Trade Commission. Justices heard arguments today over President Trump's decision to fire FTC member Rebecca Slaughter without cause. Such a ruling would overturn a 90-year-old decision that is limited when presidents can fire agencies' board members. Alina Haba, a former personal attorney for President Trump, is stepping down as the administration's top federal prosecutor in New Jersey. Her decision comes after federal appeals court found that she was unlawfully serving in the position. NPR's Ryan Lucas has more.
In a statement posted on social media, Alina Haba says she is resigning as the acting U.S. attorney for New Jersey. She says she's not surrendering in the face of legal challenges, but instead stepping down to protect the stability and integrity of the office. Still, she's leaving after a 3-judge panel for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit unanimously found that Haba had been unlawfully put into the U.S. attorney's job and disqualified her from supervising cases. That ruling was the latest blow to how President Trump has tried to install some U.S. attorneys. In her statement, Haba says she will continue to serve the Justice Department as a senior advisor to the Attorney General for U.S. attorneys. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
The White House is planning a $12 billion aid package for U.S. farmers who have struggled to sell their crops amid President Trump's tariff war. The aid is the administration's latest effort to respond to concerns over affordability, which Trump has also dismissed as a hoax. U.S. stocks pulled away from their record highs today. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. 100 of the school children abducted from a Nigerian Catholic school last month were released over the weekend. Gunmen attacked the school on November 21st, seizing more than 250 children and 12 teachers. Details surrounding their release were not made public, and the government has not said if any ransom was paid. The holiday party season is in full swing, and the alcohol is flowing. This year, some people might wake up with a nastier hangover than usual for one reason: age. NPR's Maria Godoy reports on the science behind it.
The liver enzymes that break down alcohol become less efficient as we age. Meanwhile, we lose muscle mass and replace it with fatty tissue. Muscle stores water, which dilutes alcohol in our blood. Having less muscle mass means alcohol hangs around in our bodies longer, says Johannes Truhl with Johns Hopkins.
And so what this means is that the same drink that previously maybe felt just fine now leads to a higher blood alcohol level. You feel the effects for longer.
These changes happen to both men and women as they enter middle age. While worse hangovers might not sound like a good thing, think of it as your body nudging you in the right direction. After all, the health risks of drinking alcohol increase with age. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
A California man says he has marked his 15,000th spin on the Disneyland ride based on the animated film Cars. John Allen Hale says he's been tracking his rides on Radiator Springs Racers in a notebook. He says he rode the attraction for the first time after undergoing gastric bypass and knee replacement surgeries in 2010 and 2011, and he was hooked. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
It is 4:06 on this Monday afternoon. You're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support comes from Beltrami Electric, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative with a mission to provide safe, affordable, reliable electric service. Beltrami Electric Cooperative, connecting communities, empowering life in northern Minnesota for more than 80 years. Weather tonight, snow continues with 1 to 4 inches possible, lows 7 to 11 degrees.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. One way or another, Hollywood is getting upended. It was just this past Friday that Netflix announced a deal to take over Warner Brothers Discovery, home to hits from Casablanca to Batman. Now, Paramount is mounting a hostile takeover bid. So we've invited our resident authorities to come help explain what is going on. NPR's Maria Aspen covers Wall Street. David Folkenflik covers the media. Hey to you two.
Hey there.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Hey, so David, you kick us off. My jaw dropped this morning when I saw the Paramount offer because it upends everything that we thought was going to happen just a few days ago when you were on the show. What is the latest on the fate of Warner Brothers?
Right. Don't nap because the billions are ascending.
Billions are rolling in. Yeah,
they're rolling in. The Netflix bid was valued deal at $83 billion, including debt to take over, really, Warner Brothers Studios, the HBO streaming service, so the intellectual property behind DC Comics and, as you say, Casablanca and everything in between, as well as the HBO streaming service. Meanwhile, Paramount Global, the Ellison family, this morning upped the ante. They've offered to buy all of Warner Brothers Discovery, including the cable channels such as CNN. That deal is valued at $108 billion in all.
The Ellison family who own Paramount, how big a deal would this be whenever it finally sells? What are the stakes for Hollywood?
Well, so this is a brawl of epic proportions. As you say, the Ellisons, Larry Ellison, the co-founder of Oracle, his son David Ellison, who had been with Skydance Media, they took over Paramount earlier this summer. But Paramount thinks it's still too small. And with this, they think they can compete with the like of Netflix. Here's how David Ellison, the CEO of Paramount, describes why he's interested in the deal.
We love the movie and entertainment business. We believe deeply in its future, and we want to help preserve and strengthen it. Movies are one of America's greatest exports.
And yet they fear they're just too small. Think of the fact that Disney bulked up to take on Netflix by buying most of Fox's Hollywood assets. You know, Netflix is already the world's largest streamer, already the nation's largest streamer. Netflix is saying, look, we can just sort of preempt this whole fight, get HBO, there's a streamer on board, get Warner Brothers Studios on board. We kind of closed the fight before it started.
Well, and as news journalists, I will note there are big stakes here for the news business too, CNN.
Yeah, right. Netflix isn't interested, you know, nor would Amazon or Apple appear to be the big digital titans. But for a place like Paramount, you know, which already has CBS, they want to fold CNN in and presumably slash a lot of job lines to make this deal work.
Okay, Maria, you hop in here on the Wall Street end of this. Paramount, the tactic they're using here is a hostile takeover. A, why, and B, how would that work?
Well, as the name implies, Paramount is essentially saying to Warner Brothers Discovery, well, we tried asking you nicely. Now the gloves are coming off. It's going directly to Warner Brothers Discovery shareholders. And this is where we see a difference between the executives of Warner Brothers, who usually call the shots, and its owners, who are all the investors who own the company's stock. Warner Brothers executives chose to go with the Netflix deal. So now Paramount is going to the shareholders and trying to make them a better offer. There are a couple of different kinds of hostile takeovers, but this is what's known as a tender offer. Mm-hmm. Paramount is essentially telling Warner Brothers shareholders, okay, Netflix promised you roughly $28 a share in cash and some stock, but we'll give you $30 a share, all cash. It's not a huge difference, but wouldn't you rather make more money?
I would.
And it'll be all in cash. And a Paramount deal would likely be faster to get regulatory approval. So Paramount is hoping its deal will convince enough shareholders to come over and join it.
Hostile takeovers, I mean, in general, are they effective?
They have a mixed track record. You may remember JetBlue, for example, tried to take over Spirit Airlines a couple of years ago, and that deal started with a hostile takeover bid. A judge did eventually block the deal on antitrust grounds, but there have been some hostile takeovers that have been successful. The Brazilian-Belgian brewery InBev took over Budweiser and Anheuser-Busch. Mm-hmm. That was a hostile takeover. Of course, more recently, we saw Elon Musk acquire Twitter, now X, in a deal that started as a hostile takeover.
One more question to you, Maria, and it's about foreign investors. If you read deep into the small print of this latest offer, the Paramount offer, it suggests significant foreign investors. Who are they? How would they be involved?
There is a lot of Middle Eastern money in this deal. The fine print, as you point out, says that sovereign wealth funds from Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi, Qatar would all have a stake, as well as an investment firm that's tied to China. There's also another investor that would have a stake in this deal, Jared Kushner. Of course, that is President Trump's son-in-law. We should point out a couple of things. First of all, Paramount, as David mentioned, is run by the Ellison family. Larry Ellison is one of the wealthiest people in the world. He's currently worth more than $275 billion. So it's interesting that Paramount is seeking foreign money for this. Now, it's important to note that the tender offer says these investors won't be involved in running the company. Also, Jared Kushner's involvement in this deal is a reminder of just how much President Trump looms over corporate America and especially all major corporate transactions right now.
David, what role is President Trump poised to play? Do we know?
Listen, in normal times, regulators don't take their cues from the president. These aren't normal times. Trump has clearly indicated for months that he thinks the Ellisons, who are allies, should have an inside track. Yesterday, he said Netflix bid would require him to be involved in thinking about it. But today, interestingly enough, he lashed out at Paramount for airing an interview with an ally turned critic of the president on CBS's 60 Minutes. CBS, of course, the Ellisons recently acquired. That could throw things in doubt as well.
Reporting there from NPR's David Folkenflik and Maria Aspen. Thanks to you both.
You bet.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court appeared ready to grant the president far greater control over independent agencies, upending the balance of power in Washington. In court today, the conservative majority largely backed the Trump administration's assertion that the president should be able to fire those who assist him in carrying out his duties for any reason. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
The justices heard arguments today in a case involving President Trump's firing of Federal Trade Commissioner Rebecca Slaughter. The FTC is one of a couple dozen government agencies designed by Congress to have some degree of independence from the White House. Under federal law, the FTC's five members can only be removed for cause. That didn't stop Trump from firing Slaughter back in March. A lower court found her firing unlawful, citing a 1935 precedent called Humphrey's Executor. It put limits on the president's power to remove members of some independent agencies. Today, Solicitor General John Sauer, representing Trump, asked the court to overrule Humphrey's, describing it this way.
It has become a decaying husk with bold and particularly dangerous pretensions.
The Trump administration's core argument is that Article 2 of the Constitution vests all the executive power in the president. And yet now you have a bunch of agencies making rules, deciding cases, issuing fines, doing things that affect individuals and businesses all across the country. Sauer said the people running those agencies are not accountable to the president. He argued the president must be able to remove them.
It is not proper for Congress to peel away executive power from the president and give it to someone who's not answerable to the voters.
Now, Justice Kagan said Congress meant to insulate these agencies from politics. She called that the bargain that's existed over the last century between the legislative and executive branches.
And if you take away a half of this bargain, you end up with just massive, uncontrolled, unchecked power in the hands of the president.
Attorney Amit Agarwal, representing Slaughter, said that would be a departure from history and tradition. He said presidents have understood and appreciated that the American people are better served when there are constraints on their own power. And Agarwal brought it back to the FTC. In 1914, Congress created the agency to protect consumers and businesses from unfair competition. If the court gives the president power over the agency, he warned,
tomorrow you'll have a situation where the president can come in and unilaterally decide what constitutes an unfair method of competition? What constitutes an unfair trade practice?
And Agarwal warned the same scenario could play out at other agencies, including the Federal Reserve.
Everything is on the chopping block.
Now, the Supreme Court, through its emergency docket, already signaled that it might create a special carve-out for the Fed, and it will hear arguments on that in January. But in today's case, conservative justices dismissed the idea that granting the president more powers would destabilize the government. Instead, they raised their own hypotheticals of what could happen if the court continues to insulate independent agencies from the president's control. What if Congress decided to give members 20-year terms? Why couldn't Congress just convert traditional cabinet agencies to multi-member commissions? Here's Justice Alito.
How about Veterans Affairs? How about Interior, Labor, EPA, Commerce, Education? What am I missing?
Agriculture.
Mr. Agarwal.
Agarwal acknowledged that it wasn't out of the realm of possibility for Congress to convert a small number of agencies into multi-member commissions, but he said it would have to be worked out through political accommodations between Congress and the president, and so it was unlikely. That answer didn't seem to satisfy the conservatives, including Chief Justice Roberts.
I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt, but sometimes that accommodation is greater than in other times. I mean, we have situations, let's say, where the Congress, both houses, are controlled by one party and the president is of the same party, and they may decide that the government would be structured better than by taking over these entities.
While it's difficult to predict how exactly the justices will rule, it appears Humphrey's executor is headed for further erosion, if not erasure. Toward the end of the arguments, Roberts echoed Sauer's description of the 1935 decision, calling it a dried husk. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from this date. Support for KAXE comes from Woodworks Homes, dedicated to the art of building in northern Minnesota by constructing handcrafted new homes and offering remodeling services. More at woodworksmn.com. Now it's time for your Daily Dose of Phenology.
On today's date, December 8th, 2008, the American bittersweet reveals its presence by being one of the few colorful objects still up in the trees. The American bittersweet is bright red. The berry is bright red. It has these two half sheaths that open up that are orange in color. So you've got this bright red berry and these bright orange sheaths that sort of cup it. And they all stem from a vine that climbs anti-clockwise up some plant nearby, whether it's the branches and limbs and trunk of an aspen or the climbing up of a speckled alder. Sometimes it will even climb up into balsam or spruce. but it is very revealing this time of year to see those bright orange and bright red berries as that plant climbs. It's important to note that there are two plants in this group. There is a female, which has the berries, and there's a male somewhere nearby that has no berries whatsoever and is only just a vine at this point and would be a little difficult to recognize. So when you find the one, look for the plant without the berries, the male.
For NPR comes from the station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. From BritBox, committed to helping viewers unbox the unexpected over the holidays with British TV, including original series Linley and a new season of Karen Peary, streaming at BritBox.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. This past Saturday, Brigham Young University's storied football season came to a disappointing close. The Cougars had only lost one game all year. They had a chance to make it to the college football playoff for the first time in school history, but they fell short, losing to Texas Tech 34-7. BYU has pumped millions into athletics over the years, most recently re-signing its head football coach to a lucrative deal that makes him one of the highest-paid head coaches in the Big 12 Conference. But for decades, officials and boosters of BYU have taken pride in the fact that in their community, morality and principles like frugality have always been front and center. BYU is the flagship school of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And the broader point of its athletic program has always been to spread the word of God. Winning was always secondary. But how does that play out in an era of big conferences, big TV revenue, and big payouts to student athletes? I posed that question to Kevin Reynolds when we spoke earlier today. He covers BYU football for the Salt Lake Tribune.
BYU, I think, is a little bit unique. Unlike other schools that are religiously affiliated, like Notre Dame, you could look at Boston College or Georgetown or whoever, those schools don't directly answer to any religious institution, even though they are religiously affiliated. But BYU is different because BYU is owned and operated directly by the head of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, their sponsoring institution. It plays in Provo, which is 40 minutes away from the church's power structure. The president of the university, the athletic director, they all answer to the church leadership in Salt Lake. And the people who run the church at BYU have said repeatedly that BYU athletics does not exist to win. That's not the main reason why BYU pours all this money. It is to promote the faith. And it becomes this tension where can you pour millions of dollars into football? Can you pour millions of dollars into coaches and still at the same time adhere to the frugality that they have professed as a core tenet of what BYU athletics should do? And also, can they still keep the mission? And Clark Gilbert, who is the commissioner of education for the church and oversees BYU directly, has come out and directly said last year that they will never pay for play. And if they do, it will unravel the religious mission of the university. Yet reality has looked very different from that.
What were you hearing in the days since Kalani Sitake has gotten this enormous contract, the head coach, who we should say was being lured away to Penn State and the school made a press to keep him? And this big deal was the result of that.
I think Kalani Sitake is kind of the prototypical case study in this because he himself grew up a BYU fan. He's a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He really believes in all the mission of BYU. And it became time when Penn State came in and said that they would pay almost $100 million to get Kalani Sitake, that BYU had to pay. But it does create this tension even for this person who for so long believed in what BYU was, is now watching it become maybe something different. And for Kalani, I think personally, I think he's embraced this new era of BYU and he's pushed for more resources to win more games. But at the same time, him getting that contract does also show that BYU is operating completely differently than what they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and definitely 40 years ago, where his predecessor kind of built BYU up in the 80s, but did it on a very discount deal.
And the football team ends the season just outside the playoff picture. The basketball team is spending a ton of money as well and trying to make a deep run in the tournament this year. Seems like this conversation is going to continue because the school continues to be focused on making a national impact in sporting in the coming years.
Absolutely. And from BYU's athletic department, they continuously say that winning expands the mission. And there's nothing wrong with pouring all this money into athletics because, hey, more winning equals higher stages, which is theoretically bringing more attention to the LDS Church, to BYU, and that's exactly what their mission is.
That is Kevin Reynolds, who covers BYU for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And in a statement responding to Kevin's reporting, BYU's athletics department said its spiritual mission is, quote, greatly enhanced when our influence is expanded through winning teams and high-profile players. The school emphasized it needs to, quote, be competitive when it comes to name, image, and likeness, player compensation to do that.
The Christmas season is all about visitors, right? Family, friends, Santa. But you know, in Europe, there is a different December visitor, a terrifying monster who carries a whipping stick instead of toys. And weirdly, people seem to like him. From Portland, Oregon, Dina Pritchett reports on the rise of Krampus.
It's early December, and families are gathering outside Fressen Bakery in Portland to eat Pfeffernuss cookies and Stollen and get their pictures taken for Christmas cards. But they're not lining up to see Santa. They're here for Krampus, a giant hairy monster with goat horns and gnashing teeth and a long tongue to taste your sins. Edgar Loesch owns the bakery. Growing up, his parents not only warned that Krampus would kidnap him if he misbehaved, they would literally sneak outside and rattle chains.
You go to bed and then suddenly at some point you hear like somebody shuffling outside a bedroom door, scratching on the door.
At Fressen, some pose in mock horror, some giving Krampus a high five. Amy Young brought her 2-year-old Sophie, who was surprisingly excited.
What sound does Krampus make?
Sadly, it ended the way so many holiday photo shoots do.
We were doing so good, though.
The darkness of Krampus is real. But so is the darkness of winter. Sarah Clegg is a folklorist and author of The Dead of Winter, Beware the Krampus and Other Wicked Christmas Creatures. Clegg says in medieval Europe, the end of the year was spooky season.
They are putting on antlers, going door to door, demanding treats. I mean, they're demanding money and alcohol.
And then in the 1500s, the figure of the child eater emerged.
He's horrible with like lank, greasy hair and sort of cramming children into his mouth.
Clegg says over the centuries, child eating monsters slid back in the calendar to the feast of St. Nick, kind of the stick to Santa's carrot. Krampus is just the version from the Alpine region. But Clegg says by the late 1800s, he becomes the version because of merch. Krampus chocolates, Krampus pepper grinders, and most importantly, Krampus postcards. Some scary, some silly, some something else.
There's sexy Krampus cards. There's like adult lady Krampus with a very big whip. And sort of debonair, handsome, topless Krampus. It's so fun. God, I wish it was still sold.
Recently, Krampus does seem to be making it back into popular culture. There are cutesy Krampus children's books. There's a horror film to show who shows up when you don't get into the Christmas spirit.
His name is Krampus.
You can find Krampus events from Salzburg to San Antonio. About 150 Krampuses and fans gathered in Portland for the 15th annual Krampus Parade. You'd almost think it's a merry bunch of carolers until you look closer. There are horns and antlers and bloody doll parts. Gretchen Brown carries a giant pot and is checking whether my 9-year-old can fit inside.
Would you describe your child as tough and stringy or meat falls off the bone?
You're not going to eat her, are you?
We should note that no kids were harmed. Some of the Krampuses actually handed out candy from their sacks instead of stuffing naughty children into them. But as the sun sets at 4:30, it feels right to embrace the darkness and have a little fun with it. And maybe scare a few children along the way. From Portland, Oregon, I'm Dina Pritchett.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.com. KAXE.org. Thank you to everyone who donated to KAXE this year. You've made a difference with your contributions. We can't thank you enough. You can still help us finish our year strong. Give at KAXE.org. Support for KAXE comes from the Itasca Orchestra and Strings Program's Family Christmas on Saturday, December 20th at 4 p.m. at the Rife in Grand Rapids, bringing the snowman to life with a film projection and live orchestra music to accompany. Tickets and info available at itascaorchestra.org/events. Now for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. More than 60 indigenous artifacts have been returned to Canada from the Vatican. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, First Nations, Inuit, and Métis leaders were on hand at Montreal's airport over the weekend to welcome them back.
There were 62 items in large crates on board the plane that landed on Saturday morning. Many Native leaders, as well as those involved in the repatriation efforts, were on hand. Some bowed as the crates were lowered onto the tarmac. For most, the objects on board were more than simply artifacts. One of those present was the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Cindy Woodhouse-Nepinak.
This is an important and emotional moment for many First Nations across this country. I hope it will also be an important moment for all Canadians to consider the history and the future of this country. Reconciliation isn't one stop here. Reconciliation is every single day doing this work.
Indigenous leaders in Canada have been calling for years on the Vatican to repatriate the artifacts in its collection. They met with Pope Francis in Rome in 2022 to talk about the legacy of the residential schools. At the time, they were also given a private viewing of some of the objects held by the church. They included embroidered gloves, a kayak, and a sling for carrying a baby. Some Indigenous leaders say it's not about bringing home objects or artifacts, but about bringing home memories, bringing home the dignity and power that was taken from their ancestors. The artifacts will not be available for public viewing until sometime early next year. Nepinak also says there are more artifacts in the Vatican Museum, so the work to repatriate them will continue. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
After finally being sworn in following a historic 7-week delay, Arizona Congresswoman Adelita Grijalva is using her first legislative act to fulfill a campaign promise she made to tribes across Indian country. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
In 2015, her father, the late Raul Grijalva, first introduced the Save Oak Flat from Foreign Mining Act to protect an Apache holy site east of Phoenix by stopping a congressionally approved land exchange between the U.S. Forest Service and Resolution Copper.
So maybe the foreign company has millions and billions of dollars. We have a spirit.
A decade later, the fight isn't over. The controversial land swap has been put on hold until as early as next year, and the new congresswoman is taking on that mantle by reintroducing her dad's old bill.
The bar is very high. Again, this is new to me. Not new to the family, but new to me. I mean, I hear it even from Democrats. Mining is super important. Right, but none of the ore is staying here. It's all going to China.
As for Resolution Copper, the company tells KJZZ, Grijalva has been invited to meet their workforce to talk about what they call her highly concerning bill, which they say threatens hundreds of jobs today and billions of dollars for Arizona's future. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
The Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma is concluding its emergency food assistance response this month. The tribe issued a declaration of emergency in October after the federal government announced the suspension of SNAP benefits for recipients in November. The declaration tapped millions of dollars in the tribe's reserve funds for cash assistance for Cherokee citizens and support for food pantries, meal sites, and food banks. According to the Cherokee Nation, the tribe delivered nearly $2 million in assistance to individuals and nonprofits. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for Law and Justice-related programming provided by Hobbs Strauss Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com. The Indian Arts and Crafts Board promotes Indian artists of federally recognized tribes through its online source directory. Information on this no-charge opportunity available at doi.gov/IACB, who support this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay, in theaters this Friday. From Bayer, Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The Republican-controlled House and Senate have not done much to stand in the way of President Trump, even when his actions have encroached on terrain that the Constitution reserves for them. But as NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass reports, there are signs that some Republican lawmakers are trying to reassert their independence.
When news broke last week that the Pentagon carried out a second strike on two individuals on a largely destroyed alleged drug boat in the Caribbean Sea, even some Republicans expressed alarm.
Somebody made a horrible decision. Somebody needs to be held accountable.
That's North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis.
This is our job. This is part of our oversight. That's pretty straightforward.
The strikes are not the only actions that have spurred a handful of Republicans to express a little daylight with the Trump administration. Some have criticized Trump's tariffs.
Our lobstermen, our blueberry growers, our potato farmers will pay the price.
Inaction on expiring health subsidies.
We are looking at a massive crisis unless Congress acts.
A proposed Ukraine peace plan.
It was not conservative to appease Putin, nor is it conservative to have a lack of moral clarity who's at fault at this war.
Trump's push to eliminate the filibuster.
You'd have to be smoking wizard weed to vote for that.
And his reluctance to release the Epstein files.
And he called me a traitor for standing with these women.
That was Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, before her Senator John Kennedy, Congressman Don Bacon, and Senators Josh Hawley and Susan Collins. After months of the White House steamrolling Congress on tariffs, appropriations, and military intervention, even this careful pushback is a departure, says former Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona. He says the shift is accelerating with Trump's declining approval rating and after Republicans' poor performance in off-year elections last month.
There was a lot of fear about what he could do to you electorally. That's diminishing.
Flake, who did not run for re-election in 2018 in part because he refused to unconditionally back Trump, says some lawmakers are now more willing to say aloud what they long expressed behind closed doors.
Obviously, it's behind the scenes. It's a whole different ballgame.
But this is not the first time observers declared a new era, only for Trump to firm up his grip on congressional Republicans. For example, after the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol.
Yeah, that is a fair point. I think a lot of us have been wrong on how long this has endured.
And most Republicans vocalizing their disagreements are retiring, represent competitive congressional districts, or are perennial moderates. One of those centrists, Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, says Congress has made some recent attempts to push back on the White House, like resolutions on tariffs and boat strikes, but they haven't been successful or sufficient.
I'd like to see more myself. And believe that if we don't stand up for our powers under the Constitution, nobody else will.
The framers gave Congress the power to appropriate funds, to declare war, and levy taxes, like tariffs. Republican Senate Majority Leader John Thune says it's unfair to say this Congress has relinquished its authority as an independent co-equal branch.
I don't know how much different this one is. A lot of times, if I have differences with the administration, I don't litigate them in public. But we do have a responsibility, I think, as partners to try and get an agenda done for the American people that they voted for.
Molly Reynolds, an expert on Congress at the nonpartisan Brookings Institution, says it's true this is not just a Trump-era phenomenon. Congress has been ceding power to the executive and judicial branches for decades.
And in some cases, Congress has been a willing and eager participant in sacrificing its own power to the other branches.
Reynolds says this did not start with Trump's willingness to act more unilaterally in his second term, but it did escalate the trend. Speaker Mike Johnson recently told the Katie Miller podcast that, quote, "We have this joke that I'm not really a Speaker of the House." Reynolds says there is precedent for Congress taking steps to reassert its authority, like the Watergate-era reforms that reined in the power of the president.
It was in a really different political moment than the one that we're living in now.
For one, the parties are more polarized. So Reynolds says it would be hard to envision a similar drive in Congress now to reassert power. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, Washington.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Jillian Klein. In 2015, Klein was diagnosed with breast cancer. She was 28 years old and months away from getting married. The very next day, she realized that it was the last day of open enrollment at her workplace. Usually, she just let her health insurance roll over, but now she suddenly had to decide if her plan would be enough to cover all the expenses that would come with cancer treatment.
It was all so overwhelming, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't understand copays or deductibles, but I did know that not having the right plan could be devastating. So I called Alex Mackey, the HR team member in charge of benefits. I didn't know Alex very well at this point. We were work friendly, but we weren't close. And yet she was going to be the first person outside of my parents and my fiance that I was about to tell what was happening. I was not ready to say the words, "I have cancer," but I had no choice. So I told Alex. She said, "Don't worry about a thing. I'll make sure you're enrolled in the right plan. Don't think about this again." And from that moment on, she became an unbelievable source of support. She got me enrolled in the right insurance plan. She set me up with a health advocate through the insurance company, something I didn't even know existed. And then she sat in on every call and reviewed every bill I received. She found miscodings, overbillings, double charges, and she taught me, most importantly, not to pay the first bill that I get because they're often incorrect. It's actually better to wait. She was with me, my mother, and another friend when I shaved my head and got fitted for a wig. She prepared a care package for me before I started chemo, and then she would text me on chemo days, and her messages, they were always perfect and just what I needed. Before cancer, I used to confuse being nice with being kind, and I didn't know the difference. But through this experience, I came to understand true kindness. Alex showed emotional intelligence that astounded me. She seemed to know the exact right thing to do, the exact right thing to say at each moment. Even in the middle of everything I was going through, I was in awe of her. And I think back on that time and I think about Alex when someone's in crisis or experiencing a tragedy, and I ask myself, what would Alex do?
Listener Jillian Klein of Bethesda, Maryland, honoring her unsung hero, Alex Mackey. Klein just celebrated her 10-year anniversary of being cancer-free. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
Coming up next is North Star Stories. We receive support from Clockout Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old world styles of beer as well as modern classics for 8 years now. Their tap room is open Monday through Thursday, 3 to 8, Friday and Saturday, noon to 8, and Sunday from noon to 6. More info at clockoutbrewing.com. The Minnesota DNR invites you to an introduction to snowshoeing at the Lost 40 Scientific and Natural Area, northeast of Alvwood, Saturday, December 13th from 2 to 3 p.m. Dress for the weather and bring snowshoes if you have them. A limited number of snowshoes are available by request. Advanced registration is required. Text KAXE for more info at 218-326-1234. The Park Rapids Area Library celebrates Yola Boca Flood December 15th through the 23rd. Check out any item and get a chocolate and a festively wrapped, gently used book.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's segment, a historical moment in Minnesota sports broadcasting. Then, what the city of Minneapolis is doing to improve policing, and why you may need to do some gardening yet this winter. I'm Chantel Sings. The Minnesota Wild made history with the first ever Ojibwe language broadcast of a National Hockey League game. The special stream aired on Native American Heritage Day when the Wild hosted the Colorado Avalanche. Grand Casino, the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, and the Midwest Indigenous Immersion Network partnered to produce the broadcast. Organizers say the project strengthens cultural identity and normalizes the Ojibwe language in public places. Next, the city of Minneapolis and its police department have worked together to address race-based policing and improve public safety. Producer Catherine DeSalle has more about what has changed since the murder of George Floyd.
No justice!
No peace! Prosecute the police!
After the murder of George Floyd from a Minneapolis police officer, the Minnesota Department of Human Rights discovered that the Minneapolis Police Department had a decade-long pattern of racial discrimination and unconstitutional policing. This led to a court-enforced agreement called a consent decree, whose goal is to reform the Minneapolis Police Department.
They are working hard every day, and there is a system that still has to be built.
That's our Linda Westbrook with Effective Law Enforcement for All, an independent monitoring team that's overseeing the Minneapolis consent decree. She's speaking at the Reimagining Justice Conference in Minneapolis about the Minneapolis Police Department and the systems that still need to be put in place to end race-based policing.
Systems are going to take a while. I don't want the system to hinder our ability up here to continue to build transparency and make sure that the community feels valued and engaged.
Also speaking at the conference is Ganesha Martin. She is the chief of the Minneapolis Police Department's Constitutional Policing Bureau, and she says that in order for the department to have transparency, they need to have the tools and technology to record and measure that transparency, which requires more funding to hire more officers and to purchase the new technology.
How do you actually come up with a metric to identify if a stop is race-based or not? There's not technology where you can automatically put it in as analytics. Right now, I'm in the process of trying to hire the right people that can do that type of stuff in the police department.
Ganesha says that after 2020, over 400 Minneapolis police officers either retired or left the force. With less officers on the force, Ganesha says it's hard to make the internal changes that need to happen to see a real change in policing.
Sometimes it is hard to acknowledge that police are human, and these are the humans that we are expecting to go into our communities. Whether you hate the police, love the police, they are part of this process.
The Minneapolis consent decree requires public input on any policy changes. But currently, Ganesha says there's just one person in the police department that handles all policy writing and public comments.
We actually do need a system because there is one guy who is writing policy, who is reviewing, is doing the best practices, and is taking in all those lovely comments, trying to translate them.
The conference left attendees asking if the Minneapolis consent decree is working, something that the panelists say only time will tell. or North Star Stories. I'm Catherine Dessel.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Your gardening to-do list may not be done for the year. According to the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, or DNR, now is the ideal time to prune or cut oaks without the risk of oak wilt infection. Oak wilt is an invasive fungal disease deadly to all of Minnesota's oak species. It spreads by sap-feeding beetles active in warm weather. The disease is common in east central and southeast Minnesota and is expanding north and west. More details about oak wilt can be found on the DNR's website.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. From the Colorado Rockies to the redwood forests of California, there are millions of acres of land, forests, grasslands, desert, and tundra, managed by the government. Much of this public land is under the jurisdiction of the Bureau of Land Management in the U.S. Forest Service. It's also a vast expanse of territory that ranchers use for cattle grazing. In a recent investigation, reporters found that the wealthiest ranchers benefit most from these public lands. And they write that it's taxpayers who pick up the tab. We're joined now by investigative journalist Jimmy Tobias, one of the reporters who broke this story for High Country News. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Jimmy, I just want to start by asking you briefly about the history. How did the system come about of government permits to graze on public land?
Yeah, it was born out of the New Deal era, really, as these Depression-era dust storms kind of rolled over the Great Plains. Franklin Roosevelt and his administration signed into law the Taylor Grazing Act that sort of erected this public land grazing system in which ranchers are provided with 10-year permits to access these vast landscapes of the West at very low cost.
So grazing on public land is like a lot cheaper than on private land. You say in your piece that it's about 90% cheaper. Why hasn't the government brought up the prices?
That's a great question. Yeah, in essence, ranchers pay about $1.35 to feed a cow and a calf on public lands for a month. That low figure has barely changed in decades. So like industry-wide, the $21 million collected from ranchers by the BLM and Forest Service last year was about $284 million below market rate for grazing forage last year. And, you know, there have occasionally been efforts to bump the grazing fees, but often there's political pushback. And so this is endured, and really this program is a very large subsidy to public lands ranchers.
In your piece, you list some really high-profile billionaire ranchers, people like Murdoch, Rockefeller, household names we all know. How do they benefit from the system?
Yeah, well, you know, the program was kind of built in the New Deal era to support, I think, in general, smaller ranchers. But in this day and age, many of the largest ranchers are corporations, agribusinesses, or billionaires like the ones you mentioned. And they benefit because in addition to those very low costs of grazing, you know, there are also all these subsidy programs, things like drought and disaster relief, funds for range improvements, reimbursements if their livestock are preyed on by wolves or cougars. And we calculated that in 2024, the federal government poured at least $2.5 billion into subsidy programs that public lands ranchers can access. And in many parts of the country, you know, it's also causing significant environmental degradation.
So I know that you reached out to ranchers, big and small, over the course of your reporting. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, we heard a wide range of things. I mean, one of the things we heard is that, you know, it's often very costly and difficult to, you know, implement the best sort of environmental protection measures because of the economic pressures they face. We also heard that, you know, many of the smaller ranchers would likely go out of business if they weren't able to access some of these subsidies. You know, we also heard questions about whether some of these wealthiest ranchers should be getting subsidized.
You write that the Trump administration plans to make this ranching permit system more generous, so opening up even more acreage. And I know that you reached out to the Trump administration you're reporting. What did they have to say about the system?
You know, they didn't really provide a lot of substantive comment. But again, we were able to access public records and look into the political appointees who are sort of shaping policy. You know, one of the most influential political figures at the Interior Department, which oversees much of this public lands grazing, is herself a rancher and a very prominent attorney for ranching groups. And they've spent a lot of their time, you know, the administration has spent a lot of its time this first year rolling back conservation rules that the public lands ranching industry opposes.
Jimmy, based on your reporting, where do you see the system headed?
Most likely it's going to sort of remain in gridlock as it has. But I think it's important for the public to understand, you know, the face of the system today, that you know, it is disproportionately benefiting some of these really large or wealthy ranchers, and that it's causing significant environmental degradation in many parts of the West. Those are issues that I think the taxpayers should know about, because they're, you know, they're on the hook for this program at the end of the day.
Jimmy Tobias is an investigative journalist and one of the co-authors of a new piece for High Country News and ProPublica. It's called "The Wealthy Profit from Public Lands and Taxpayers Pick Up the Tab." Thanks so much, Jimmy.
Thank you.
What do you hear during your commute? Many of us are popping in headphones, maybe even listening to NPR, but one train enthusiast in New York listens to the world around him. When he was a student at Buffalo State University, Bennett Cook recorded the ambient sounds and found something surprising. His resulting podcast, a finalist in NPR's College Podcast Challenge, may change the way that you hear your commute. Here's an excerpt from his entry, Transit Sounds.
I have recently discovered a few subways that actually make music when they are leaving the station. The first subway is the Montreal Metro MR63. When this train leaves or arrives at different stations, the sound of a cello arises from the metro. Feel free to close your eyes and listen to this audio clip. Call me crazy, but if you listen really carefully and deeply, you can hear this instrument in the metro during the acceleration. All you cello musicians out there, consider this your challenge to match the tune heard from the metro itself. The next subway in the musical category is Boston, in which the music there is the door chime. When the doors close, the sound of a wooden xylophone arises, but there is also a violin that arises from the train as it leaves the station. Adding to that point, the tune you'll hear is a very tiny snippet of a song by Etta James called At Last. Take a listen. Did you hear that? Did you hear Etta's violins? Today, I have touched upon just two examples of the many that are waiting to be discovered by you, the listener. Like the organs of the Senate subway of Washington, D.C. in the White House, the violins of both the Barcelona Metro 4000 or the Madrid Metro 3400 series. Isn't it fascinating that if you listen carefully and pay close attention, you will find music in the most unexpected places? For me, I was pleasantly surprised to find music underground, complementing my passion of transit. So the next time you leave your home, keep your ears open, and you too will be surprised to discover what the sounds of life have to offer.
That was an excerpt from Transit Sounds by Bennett Cook, who was a finalist in the 2021 NPR College Podcast Challenge. He has since graduated from Buffalo State and recently accepted a job at, surprise, surprise, the Chicago Transit Authority to work on trains.
Support for NPR's Student Podcast Challenge comes from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. From Heifer International, where people can donate animal gifts to families living in poverty. Whether it's a goat, chicken, or cow, each gift is intended to help families earn a sustainable income. Heifer.org/NPR. And from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. This is NPR.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Programming is supported by The Forge in Grand Rapids, offering a space where students, entrepreneurs, and workers can bring their ideas to evolve into products, careers, or businesses, building a culture of innovation and diversity in the heart of Itasca County. Learn more at theforgeitasca.org, where ideas take shape. You can cut your own Christmas tree in the Superior or Chippewa National Forests. Permits are now available at recreation.gov. You may also stop by a district office to get a permit. Looking at weather, we are under a winter weather advisory in effect until 6 a.m. tomorrow, with a winter storm watch to follow. Expect slippery road conditions.